This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. John Critcher is a professor of biology at Wheaton College who teaches courses in ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution. He's the author of more than 100 professional papers and a dozen books on nature and ecology, including the highly regarded field guide, A Neotropical Companion. Dr. Critcher recently spoke with the Cincinnati Zoo's Thane Maynard.
Dr. John Critcher, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here, Thane.
Well, it's fun to talk to you. You know, you've written some very significant books. At the Cincinnati Zoo, where I work, we regularly take groups to places like Costa Rica and Belize. And, of course, your book, The Neotropical Companion, is really remarkable. It's been out a long time, but still is of tremendous use if you're taking people to a tropical rainforest.
Well, I appreciate that. I just put the third edition to bed.
That is great. Well,
it's going to be published, in February, March 2017, and it's overdue for revision, but you're right. I mean, it has had a good run, and I'm hoping it keeps that way.
Well, a fun thing that I've observed over the years is with the advent of newer and better field guides to birds and plants from places around the world, even electronically, so you can pull them up. And books like yours, you know, the accessibility for even people that aren't familiar with an ecosystem to really immerse themselves is a neat thing. I think it's encouraging.
Yes, it's remarkable. You're absolutely right. When I first wrote my Neotropical Companion first edition and then followed it with a second edition, I did a lot of comments about the realities of the difficulties of field identification and, in general, travel in high biodiversity areas, and that's all changed. There are wonderful places to stay, and there are field guides to every country. There are field guides to everything from invertebrates to, as you mentioned, birds, mammals. It's a great thing. At the same time, though, it happens when there's more and more loss of habitat, not only in the tropics, but every place else. It's really quite ironic that the more we learn, the more we seem to need to focus on conservation.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, with a lot of years on us that I think you and I both probably have, you can think, man, we're starting to know more and more about less and less. But on the other hand, and I know you are a professor of biology at Wheaton College, it's got to be heartening that so many young people care so much.
It is. We have many students here. I'm at the Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, and we have many students who go on to graduate school, PhD programs, and various other programs. And what is also remarkable is how many students do various junior year or other projects in other locations. I have a student who's one of my star students who just spent fall semester working in conservation biology in South Africa and succeeded well enough to get invited back there to continue this coming summer. The opportunities are remarkable.
They really are, and a couple of my daughters have done some of those same things. So the fact that more people are both interested and aware and really trying to help solve some problems hopefully can help. But of course, what really helps is that nature, thank goodness, is built to be resilient, which brings me to another one of your books that I enjoyed a great deal, The Balance of Nature. It's been out a few years, but it sort of debunks some of the myths that people hold about how nature works.
Yes, that was its intention. The concept of balance of nature is one of those things that's more philosophical than scientific. It makes a certain amount of intrinsic sense, and I can easily understand, looking back into history, why it emerged to be such a predominant concept. It would take longer than we probably have to go into that, but the truth is that for many years, including up through the mid-20th century, it was a predominant concept among professional ecologists. And it wasn't until, I would say, if I had to pick a date, about 1940 or so, that ecologists began to realize how changeable nature is within a certain scale. The whole concept comes down to scale. You can have the example I use in my book is if you look at any place on Earth, just pick it and look at it and decide to have some kind of time-lapse photography of it, it will never stay the same. It will change. And it changes because of climate. It changes because of organisms. It changes for multiple reasons. And the biggest source of change on the Earth now is, of course, human activities. But my idea with the book was to show that the balance of nature is not a scientific concept. It doesn't mean it's a meaningless concept. We should be very concerned about nature, but we shouldn't be concerned from the standpoint of upsetting the balance of nature. As you said, nature is resilient, but resilient doesn't necessarily mean recovering the biodiversity that's been lost. It just means that nature goes on. I heard Paul Ehrlich give a talk at the very first Earth Day in 1970, and the title of the talk was Nature Bats Last. And I thought that was a very interesting title because, in fact, what we're seeing with climate change is how we have affected nature in a way that may create very negative impacts in some areas, but that's just the way it's going to be. And with regard to things other than humans, there's nothing we're going to do that's going to change the fact that the Earth will remain a biological Earth. It'll just be a different mixture of species.
That is true, and the concept of nature bats last is really something. And I'll tell you what, you have seen a lot if you were at the very original Earth Day 46 years ago. And you've probably seen some change over the years you've taught in how your students perceive things.
That's absolutely true. When I first started, there was a great enthusiasm because I first began my career at Wheaton in the summer of 1970, right after the first Earth Day had happened. And I was oddly a bit of a minor celebrity on campus because I was talking about ecology, and it was the buzzword at the time. But what I have seen much more significantly about my students is how many of them now focus their undergraduate careers, at least, in environmental areas. And we've created an environmental science major, as many other colleges have. We have many students taking environmentally related courses, and we have great integration among all our courses with environmental concepts, even courses like biochemistry and molecular biology. So, yeah, that has definitely changed.
Exactly. So as a scientist, on the one hand, you understand these problems are global and we're not going to really change, if you will, the way that nature's balancing itself or adjusting to these changes. So what's a person to do? They don't want to just go out and buy a polluting diesel vehicle and drive around. Do they give a hoot, not give a hoot, or try to protect land? What do you think?
I think fundamentally, people who become really focused on thinking about nature try very hard to do things in their lives which reflect positively on the potential for most people are interested in maintaining biodiversity for a variety of reasons. And it can be small things like using coffee that comes from shade-grown coffee plantations rather than coffee that comes from sun-grown, which destroys forests, putting in, at least in my neighborhood in Cape Cod, more and more people are putting in solar panels and various things because they're economically useful in the long run. I think that, I don't know whether I can say I'm optimistic or pessimistic. It's going to be what it's going to be. But I know a lot of people who contribute funds to organizations, I won't name them, but to organizations that are dedicated to conservation principles and who buy up land and who protect species and pay for surveys and that sort of thing. Those are all things we can do. Those are things we could we have been able to do for many years. To the extent that they have efficacy, that's good. I'm not sure. I don't think we're exactly spitting into a tidal wave as far as the future is concerned, but I do have concerns about it.
Absolutely. An interesting thing that seems to be evolving, while we don't seem to have the great groundswell that you referenced in the late 60s, early 70s about the first Earth Day, I do think there's a growing awareness, even with corporations and others, of the fact that protecting areas and keeping air and water clean aren't just helpful to frogs and songbirds. Because, of course, here in Cincinnati, where I am, we drink out of the Ohio River, so it's a big concern. So this idea that doing things smarter is really helping people, not just helping wildlife.
It does. And one of the things that has emerged in ecology and also involves economics, and you know, it's interesting, the prefix of ecology and economics is the same, econ, mm-hmm. which is a house in Greek. Ecologists and economists have come together more and more to look at the concept of what's called nature services and the realization that a certain amount of the Earth's surface in a natural state produces very positive effects for humans, things ranging from purification of water and air, et cetera, pollination. And if we eliminate them, we have to replace them in an economic way. A good example, for instance, is the abundance of mangrove trees in tropical coastal areas. Those mangrove forests, just like salt marshes in coastal areas in North America, in some places at least, have been removed in order to do things like shrimp farming or fish farming. And that exposes the coast directly to typhoons, hurricanes, that sort of thing. And the cost of those events is greater on the society than the benefit to a few who are able to profit from the shrimp farms, for instance. And so more and more serious studies are being done with real numbers and real data rather than just arguments to show that leaving ecosystems intact in some areas and leaving biodiversity intact is ultimately, as you just said, as beneficial to humans as it is to the nature it's meant to protect.
And hopefully as people learn more, one of the things they'll learn is to cooperate one with another to do something that's for the common good and not just exploit areas. Well, Dr. John
Critcher. Well, now that's the big question, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Dr. John Critcher, thank you for spending a few minutes with us. As I said, I've greatly enjoyed your books, particularly The Neotropical Companion, so keep up the good work.
Okay, I appreciate that, Thane. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
My guest has been Dr. John Critcher of Wheaton College.